As you listen to this commentary, I am on the Blue Ridge Parkway, enjoying the turning of the leaves after a restful week at a cabin near Asheville. I've lost a week in the writing of my new book, Drawing Back the Curtain, but the stress of deadlines was getting serious. It was time for a break. I hope you'll consider buying a copy or multiple copies of this new book for two reasons. The first reason is that I expect this to be the last of my five books, and in it I draw back the curtain on my 57-year broadcast career with no holds barred. I've written of my early childhood as a poor kid in eastern North Carolina and the dysfunctional family life I lived in for the first 16 years of my life. And so, in this book, I simply recap portions of it to give perspective to the reader. In this book, I reveal many things that you haven't heard because of the dishonest progressive media. For decades, I have spent copious amounts of hours in deep research to document my weekly commentaries. I reveal that research by drawing back the curtain. In this book, I share my thoughts and opinions on the past and future issues we all have faced. I base those opinions on the knowledge I have accrued through 57 years in the media, 52 of those years in talk radio, long before there was a Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity. I respect both of them, but when I began in talk radio, it was a pioneering time for conservative views. The second and perhaps most important reason to buy this book is that all of the profits go to help our wounded veterans. I keep not a cent, nor charge for any overhead expenses. For details on how to order my book, just email me at tom@tomjoyner.net. That's tom@tomjoyner.net. I recorded today's commentary just before leaving on the 12th of October, and tomorrow I'll be back at work finishing the book. And I share credit for today's commentary with L. Todd Wood of the Washington Times, the esteemed Walter Williams, and Carol Linnett of the University of Victoria. There are many ways to destroy a society, and if it is done stealthily and effectively, you must make society destroy itself. To keep society from defending itself, you must destroy the religious ideals that built the country and held it together, allowing it to thrive and be exceptional. In short, it's necessary to destroy Christianity in the West. Then you move on to destroy the family, the fabric of society. Tear apart the nuclear family that produced stable children, future contributors to the nation's wealth and power. Next, you promote a gay agenda, one that targeted fertility and the subsequent lowering of the birth rate. You would make children not know what gender they are, just totally confuse them. And then you must destroy the centuries-old family unit that produced generations of Americans that became the most powerful country on earth. A society that does not reproduce is a dying society. You'd also want to promote the concept of toxic masculinity and extremist feminism. What better way to make society less masculine and less able to field a strong military? Push as many women as possible into the armed forces and put those women on the front lines. Then make the military conduct societal experiments rather than focus on fielding the strongest arms forces possible, the most lethal, the most dangerous for our enemies. In doing this, officers in training should be forced to wear high heels to feel what it's like to be a woman. In short, you feminize the male population making it less effective in battle. From there, you move on to destroy the education system. Marxist professors have to be planted throughout the university system, teaching new generations nothing about American history, but filling their heads full of communist propaganda. They would hear nothing about Washington, Lincoln, or Jefferson, but much about Malcolm X, Fidel Castro, and Lenin. And don't forget about the importance of dividing the races. What better way, what better method of dividing and conquering than to foster a raging race war, filling minorities' heads full of lies of police brutality and developing a culture of hate toward law enforcement? Teach the children to fear the police instead of obeying the police. Then you'd need to corrupt federal government. You'd fill the intelligence and security services with traitors to the nation's founding. When any political figure arose to threaten the diabolical agenda, you'd take these corrupt agencies and target and frame them on any rising star who loved America, even if they were a duly elected president of the United States. Of course, you'd need to take away the population's means to defend itself, meaning you must take away all of the guns. The fear of an armed population would stop any invasion by outside forces. So you must get rid of that problem. Along the way, you'd need to destroy self-reliance and ingenuity by making over half of the population dependent on government, unable to take care of themselves. High tech would need to be used to completely remove any viewpoints or ideas that were associated with the old America. Just ban them from the internet. You might take developing internet censorship to eventually prevent opposing views from being heard by anyone at any time. And it would be necessary to corrupt the nation's leadership with money, finding those who would sell out the country for pieces of silver. Write so-called tell-all books stemming from their access to power. Shell out lots of money throughout the legislature to make sure no laws were passed that opposed the agenda. We'd need to promote the disrespect of the nation's symbols, have people kneel during the national anthem, burn the flag, tear down statues of the nation's history, make the people hate the very fabric of the nation that gave them such wealth, freedom, and power. And you'd need a straw man in your quest to destroy the country. Find a country that is a malicious adversary to America, though much less powerful, and then focus all of the negative energy and recriminations toward this straw man country. In this manner, the targeted nation would be ignorant of true intentions. The regime that would promote all of this change in the targeted country would be the largest communist regime in the world. It would have a 100-year plan to destroy its enemies and become the dominant force on the planet. It would have millions of its own citizens in concentration camps. It would force abortions on women and sterilization of those it did not want to reproduce within its own borders. Many of its workers would live as slaves in this modern world, with a life of no meaning. Its factories would have suicide nets around the roofs to prevent these workers from killing themselves in despair. This nation would kill tens of thousands of its own citizens who dared stand up for a future of freedom. Everything I have just said is happening right now in front of your eyes. And I'll give you a hint. It's not Russia. Moments of social disruption are a valuable reminder that so much of what we take for granted, our sense of normalcy, isn't necessarily normal at all. So much of our thinking about how the world actually works is conditioned by what we have experienced and what we are able to anticipate based on that experience. Our ability to understand a government's response to something like a pandemic, what the government should or should not do, is affected by our collective sense of what is acceptable. Right now, extraordinary and previously unimaginable responses are being taken to contain the novel coronavirus pandemic and lessen its toll families have been separated by. Public places have been shuttered, trillion-dollar bailouts announced. It's a time of quarantines and wartime hospital triage. Such monumental and disruptive efforts are all being undertaken to counteract the tightening grip of a novel coronavirus, an entity not even visible to the human eye. These extraordinary measures are evidence of our collective ability to reconstruct a new sense of normal, rearranging our lives to fit a shifting landscape of novel and emerging priorities. And yet these actions also reveal how changeable the operations of the normal world can become in the face of new pressures. The American government has harnessed enormous political power and capital to help businesses, workers, and families cope with current and anticipated financial stress. Trillions of dollars have been allocated for relief programs to support some of society's most vulnerable populations, including indigenous communities. The financially vulnerable, those seeking violence, or fleeing rather violence, or in need of mental health support. Like taking apart a mechanical device to see how it's made and view its component parts, the breakdown of our normal world reveals aspects of our reality and its social constitution that's not visible in everyday life. The COVID-19 pandemic reveals what philosopher Isabel Stengers describes as the hidden gap between the probable and the possible. The probable represents a history of thought that simply appears as common sense. Under the logic of a capitalistic paradigm, for example, it is not probable that governments would allow for the student's suspension of student loan debt or the creation of a basic income subsidy for millions. But that does not mean that extraordinary measures are not possible. In many ways, our shared sense of what is normal and probable is conditioned by both capitalism and our social histories. But these expectations, according to Stengers, prevent other possibilities, other realities from appearing or from appearing sensible. Yet important questions remain when the world breaks down, like, how should we put it back together? Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, catalogs the way power operates in times of chaos in order to capitalize on social harm and distraction to generate profits. America has already been rolling out trillion-dollar bailout packages to prop several industries up. That corporate executives are seizing upon this pandemic as an opportunity to advance corporate interests and lobby for the rollback of more environmental regulations is an important reminder that moments of disruption can be seized upon to serve the status quo and society's greatest powers. Stengers helps us understand why the opportunistic behavior of these multinational corporations seem completely normal. It appeals to help business, to stabilize the economy, to create jobs. All seem a matter of due course in unstable times. A multi-billion-dollar bailout for industry is floated as simply a matter of common sense. It is, we are told, what's best for us. But who and what is actually represented in that us? Marginal communities and ecological systems share a common bond in that they represent interests and needs often not reflected in executive decision-making, in the arguments of lobbyists, and the fine print of economic stimulus packages. In these times, more than ever, it becomes an urgent imperative that world building and decision making take place somehow in the presence of those who will bear the consequences of it. The advent of COVID-19 is a particular disruption, but one that points out so many other disruptions at work and in our lives. Disruptions like global inequality, the climate emergency, rampant species extinction, and resource depletion. By exposing the fragility of the normal world, the pandemic also offers us an opportunity to make lives less precious and social institutions more robust, and thinking more free to consider not the probable world, but the possibility of building a better world. Mankind spends its time griping and pointing fingers at everyone but ourselves. Rather than buckle down and try to enjoy the life we have been given in this free country, we fuss and we fret. We have developed a political system that threatens to swamp us all. The two political parties don't even try to reach common ground anymore upon which to make life better for the citizens. Even a worldwide pandemic is used for political gain by blaming a human being, in this case, President Trump, rather than the source that gave the world this pandemic, China. How is this coronavirus Donald Trump's fault? What do we gain by nitpicking efforts to contain this virus? We live in a fragile universe. In less than 1 second, the world could fall victim to a catastrophe, such as a nuclear war. As I record this commentary, scientists say there's a 98% chance that an earthquake of at least a magnitude 7 will hit the San Francisco Bay Area in the next few days. We live in uncertain times. I'll give you an example. What if Yellowstone National Park's supervolcano erupted? With its spouting geysers, majestic mountains, awe-inspiring waterfalls, and panoramic views, Yellowstone National Park has the undeniable power to uplift. We've visited the park several times and marveled at its beauty. But it also has an unparalleled potential to destroy. Concealed beneath the park rests the Yellowstone Caldera, the largest supervolcano in North America. Each year, millions of visitors trek over a massive magma chamber that, according to the United States Geological Survey, or USGS, stretches from 5 kilometers to 17 kilometers beneath the surface and is about 90 kilometers long and 40 kilometers wide. A little deeper down rests another chamber that's 4.5 times larger. The Yellowstone supervolcano has unleashed 3 cataclysmic eruptions in the past 2.1 million years, all well before humans populated North America. The most recent eruption was 640,000 years ago, which formed Yellowstone as we know it today, and spewed 240 cubic miles of ash, rock, and pyroclastic materials over roughly half of what is now the United States. So what would happen if Yellowstone were to erupt again? Science writer Brian Walsh explored that subject in a frightening detail in his book End Times, A Brief Guide to the End of the World. He described Yellowstone National Park that would be literally erased from the face of the continent. He said, first would come a swarm of increasingly intense earthquakes, a sign that magma was rushing to the surface. the pressure would build until, like champagne in a bottle, given a vigorous shake, the magma would burst through the ground in a titanic eruption that would discharge the toxic innards of the earth into the air. It would continue for days, burying Yellowstone in lava within a 40-mile radius of the eruption. But the devastation would not be restricted to the local environment. Yellowstone's plume of ash, lava, and volcanic gases would reach a height of 15 miles or more, and from this lofty position, be blown across North America. Ash would darken the skies and blanket the ground from coast to coast, with up to 3 feet of ash in the northern Rockies and a few inches over much of the Midwest. Hospitals would be choked with victims, coughing up blood as the silicate in the ash slashed their lungs. The heavy ash would collapse roofs, contaminate water supplies, down power lines, prevent air travel, and perhaps even take out our electrical transformers, bringing the nation's power grid to its knees. Worse still, falling ash would likely wipe out the Midwest crops of corn and soybeans should the eruption occur during the growing season. Much of America's rich farmland might also be poisoned for a generation. Combine all that with a likely volcanic winter, in which global average temperatures would plunge as much as 18 degrees and stay there for a decade. And with that, you have a recipe for a global starvation event that could endanger hundreds of millions of people. In every past catastrophic occurrence, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, most of the United States remained untouched, which meant that safe parts of the country could divert aid to and take refugees from the affected regions. But no corner of the continental United States would be exempt from the effects of a super volcano in Yellowstone. If you want to put a dollar cost on it, a FEMA estimate pegged the total damage to the United States from a Yellowstone supervolcano at $3 trillion, some 16% of our country's gross domestic product. So what are the chances this could happen? Thankfully, those chances are very low. It's possible, but it's very low. The USGS estimates the probability at 1 in 730,000 in any given year. The USGS monitors Yellowstone very carefully for any signs of an impending eruption. Their precaution could alert us to such an event years in advance, which would at least grant us some time to prepare. I decided to include this information about the volcano in Yellowstone in today's commentary to show that we are all here by the grace of God, and why this division and backbiting among our people is foolish. In a moment, you and I could no longer be here. All of the political power in the world isn't worth the damage we do to one another. Let's all agree in the future to disagree, but not be disagreeable. The fact that we have human beings among us willing to wish a coronavirus death upon the president or anyone else they don't like should alarm us all greatly. By now, we have heard what the forecast is for those who have, but political figures, who have picked up the COVID-19 virus. Any of us could get it. It's easy. We take precautions. Most of us wear masks and we practice social distancing, but the least little thing could cause you to have the virus. Today we went in a store, Ann and I, and got a cart, one of those that you push. We had some wipes with us to clean the where we have our hands. But even so, it doesn't take much for you to put your finger on something that will later cause you to have COVID-19. It really does bother me that we have such animosity in our country, that we are so divided, race against race, men against women, children against their parents. It's everywhere. We're asking for trouble, and we'll probably get it. I hope you'll all get out and vote November 3rd. If you've got to vote for Democrats, then at least do your part. I can't vote for Democrats. I can't vote for Joe Biden or for Kamala Harris. The socialism that they are surrounded by, that they bring to this country if elected, is startling. You're actually electing Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez when you vote for Joe Biden. I don't like about everything about Donald Trump's personality. He can be a pain in the fanny from time to time. But hey, I loved my daddy, and he could be a pain in the hiney for a certain time. You don't elect a president based on their personality. You elect a president based on what they can do for the country, and Trump has shown what he can do for this country. Until the Chinese virus was foisted upon us, Trump had this country in the greatest position it's ever been, and he'll bring it back. So I have already voted for Donald Trump. But I hope that you will turn out and vote. We cannot allow the Senate to be taken over by Democrats. America as we know it would be finished. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week, God willing, same time, same station, and God bless America.